Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the French Connections Thursday edition. Today's date is the 27th day of March 2008. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here with me again for another installment of the French Connection. Lots of things going on in the world, of course. Again, financial situations are continuing to complicate everyone's lives. What's happening with these finances that I'm starting to see everywhere is that people are resigning themselves to the fact that we are heading into a depression. Now, the depression word isn't ever used in the press. Basically, when you have a downturn in the economy and you have negative growth, in other words, a shrinking of the economy, that is a depression. The word recession came in far later than that word depression as a means for politicians to explain away negative bumps or negative growth in the economy where it didn't sound like the world was coming apart. Because what you need to understand, ladies and gentlemen, is that confidence in an economy, especially an economy that relies heavily on consumption, needs to keep the people consuming. And words do matter. And so they realized that a long time ago, and since about $6.5 out of every 10 comes from the public spending into the economy by buying white goods and homes and clothing and whatnot, when people become nervous about their future and their economic future, they pull their purse strings closed, and what's the result? A deepening of the problems that we already face. Now, you know, most of this could have been avoided. Everyone knows that. We could have avoided it by taking the $3 trillion that's costing us in Iraq and put that toward our debt service, or we could have used it to, you know, put toward revamping our infrastructure in the country, or our systems of roads so that we have better movement between factories, or tax breaks for people to build factories, or a thousand things we could have done to help build America back up. Instead, what we've been doing is tearing it down, and I believe it's all intentional, as do many of the people who listen to this program. It's an implosion process that's been going on for, as you'll learn today, over 100 years. I have a guest today. Somebody I'm very familiar with. She's been in my life for a very long time, and I trust the fact that her work is going to be non-biased and well-researched. And she is coming to us for her second interview ever. Don't let that color your ideas about what Jennifer is going to share with us today. She's got a lot of information about the history of the medical system in our country and the education system, in fact, and its roots back to this criminal gang. No surprises there for anybody when we're doing this research that it ends up going back to these people in almost every case. So, Jennifer, are you with me?
I'm with you, Jack.
Good. It's great to have you here with me today, Jen. I got to say that the first time I heard this information was a few years ago. I didn't hear all of it, but I heard bits and pieces of it. And I saw the results of these things on the ground. In other words, our education system has been making poor and less capable and less competent students and ultimately less competent workers for generations now. And I watched the degradation and destruction of that education system back in the 70s and 80s. What we're finding out is that there was somebody behind that. In the beginning, was there not an individual who took over charge of education policy at the urgings of some very powerful people?
Well, there was. There's no doubt that this was all done by design.
Yep.
The man really who was able to implement that into society, that as we know it, his name is Abraham Flexner, and he's very famous among medical students. Because his report that he created, at the time he was on the payroll of the Carnegie Foundation, but he would later come to be hired by Rockefeller, not that there's really a whole lot of distinction between the two.
No.
But Rockefeller created the General Education Board. He sat on that board from 1912 to 1925. And what he had done by creating this report, and if people want to go and read it online, they can do that. It's called the Carnegie Bulletin No. 4, and it was published in 1910. But this just reframed the whole procedure of financing for education.
Now, is this really the first time, from what you were looking at, is this really the first time that the federal level was getting involved in state education processes? In other words, most of our education was done on a state level. We had individual school boards, we had individual school systems, and then they would receive some help from the state they were located in. But this is the first time that a national element was being placed into the education system, was it not?
Well, yeah. You know, education sort of lags behind some of the other social conventions that were going on. In a way, they developed together, but medicine would really make the model for that.
Now, the medical schools, again, to provide doctors for across the country for the public, they came up with the idea that each state would sponsor its own medical school. Now, of course, you know, Massachusetts General Hospital works with University of Massachusetts to produce doctors, and University of Hawaii does the same for the state of Hawaii. So what we've got across the country is 50 states providing funding for medical education, but somehow the federal people got involved in kind of mandating what kind of information was going to be provided in those medical schools. Am I correct?
Well, yes, you are. You know, these were kind of sweeping ideologies. What I think it grew out of, when I look back at history, is really the development of public health law and public health education. So that's why the medical model precedes the education. Society really organizes itself around very few things, and survival is its main objective. And so personal health, community health, national health, these are the issues that caused all these other things to start falling in line.
Well, now, there needed to be an impetus for this kind of legislation to make its rounds across America. And there was another brother from that group, the Flexner Trio, as we're going to learn in a couple of minutes. There are three brothers. The other brother, not Abraham, what's the other brother's name?
Simon
Flexner, yes. Now, he was also involved in medical things, but on a different in a different way, and he was giving impetus for his brother Abraham to provide cause let me rephrase this. They needed a reason in each state to have these public health situations controlled, and he was going to be there with the problems to do that with. If you're getting my drift here, this is a tough one to kind of describe here.
Okay, well, I think I'm getting drift. Simon was older than Abraham, gave him a hand up as a big brother, and brought him into this. Abraham himself formed his own little high school academy back in Kentucky. You know, he was really someone who, you have to put him in his time period. He was doing something that was very democratic at the time. All of this stuff, really, when you talk about having feds get involved, looking at, you know, big social changes that occurred, and that there was really a vacuum for this huge oversight on all these systems. Everything was very democratic.
Well, now Simon also had direct links to Rockefeller, but in a different part of his organization, in this research area for biogenetic researching that went on early in the beginning of the last century. No,
that's kind of assuming that things were very compartmentalized at that time. They were not.
So they were working the same project for in different parts of the government, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
For different departments of their control.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that the prevailing idea of all of this is eugenics.
That's right. And wasn't it a very important subject at the time worldwide? A lot of There were a lot of societies growing up around the idea that we could manipulate our genetics to get rid of the sick and infirmed, and you see the growing of this eugenics social movement in Europe as well, in Germany, in America, and it was growing up in a lot of places, and it was feeding on the idea that race specific groups are one better than the other, or one better looking, or better health, or better this, or better that. And there was really a belief that if you got rid of certain people or certain groups, that you were not, one, going to have fewer resources shared with these people, but secondly, you were going to strengthen the group that was left behind. And this is an idea that was given a lot of play and a lot of financing back in the beginning of the last century. Am I correct?
You are. It's interesting to know who coined the term eugenics. The man who did that was the cousin of Charles Darwin. And what evolved from that were, everything that was able to spawn. It took the scientific method, brought it into social. You have the rising of social Darwinism. Most people are familiar with.
Yes, the survival of the fittest, yep.
Uh-huh. And eugenics, the meaning of the word eugenics means well-born, and it was thought to be, and of course it was propagated as a noble idea, and during Romantic Victorian times, this had traction. This was the big idea.
1860s through 1890s, that period there, yes?
And on.
Yes.
Because eugenics never went anywhere.
Well, it has never died since, which we're going to learn later in this conversation. Yeah.
So, this is the ideological impetus to have these things occur.
Mm-hmm.
And became very popular in the church. The clergy was hugely responsible for spreading this idea.
Now, what particular group of clergy? Catholicism? Lutheranism? What group?
Calvinism, Lutheranism, Protestants in particular. That's what, gave it a foothold, at least in America, as far as I can see. I'm not really focused on that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
I've read the philosophers, and I'm confronted with these ideas. They just keep coming back up.
Well, I always knew that Northern Europeans were a Protestant, and they looked down at the Mediterranean peoples as being less than them. If you would notice the immigrants into America, the Italian communities and the Spanish were always looked down as a group that was not as prolific in the arts or particular. In other words, they weren't held as high in value in the North American society as the blonde or blue. That's where this kind of...
Well, that's an advantage taking of an idea.
That's right.
Pervasive in all cultures.
Yes, it is.
In all cultures.
Mm-hmm.
There are examples in North America where, the Indians, among the Iroquois were called the League of Nations, and they were separate tribes that bonded together for, larger reasons of survival and cultivation. But they had, tribes within that organization themselves that considered themselves to be special and chosen, and they looked down on the others. So this... Everywhere.
Yeah, this is a. They're, in other words, what they're doing is keying into something, a trait in human groups and in social groups to think that they're better than the group next to them.
Right, and it really became something defined when it became part of religious dogma.
Okay. Yeah.
That people, the early Protestants called themselves separatists.
Right.
And this idea of being separate and being special and being chosen out as something. More worthy. This, codified.
Well, we know where that's ended up in this past century till now, and we've got the supremacy of the chosen again, rearing up against all of humanity as we speak. Now, let's go back for a minute here to Simon Flexner and his entrance into the research arm of medicine, where he started looking at disease. Functions and how disease was working its way into societies, and what they could do to use that condition to their benefit in this eugenics mindset.
Okay, your question, sir. Let's see. Well, you know, the first thing really is just to figure out who this guy is.
Yeah.
Now, he came from this family. Of course, he mentioned that he had at least two other brothers that were interested in him. Jesus Mullins, by the way, written extensively on what the new world order paradigm is about, mentions all three of them. The book called Murder by Injection. But I didn't read the book, what I got from it, what I got online about it, and I don't know how much he elaborated on that. But Simon Flexner was one of these people who benefited from the democratic nature of medical education at the time.
Yep.
Meaning, was, you know, no one was required to their education in a standardized, licensed, certified.
In other words, the moniker of a medical doctor, M.D., through a schooling system was not yet set in stone.
That's right.
Yeah.
They called these proprietary schools.
Mm-hmm.
Usually they were set up by an owner who also decided the curriculum and you know, got financing and provided, you know, the whole means by which people would get education. So these proprietary schools are what most positions for getting their training. The exception to that would be those that went to Europe. And the European schools, especially the German schools, at that time were considered to be very well endowed institutions of learning.
Yeah.
So most of these small proprietary schools were what Americans had to rely on to get a medical education in those days. And so Simon Flexner apparently got an education. What the limit for most people at that time, about 2 years of training.
Mm-hmm.
So unlike what we have today, no doubt. But he taught himself how to use a microscope. And in biographies of his that I went looking for, and I came up with so many, by the way, and they gave a lot of information. But what I could discern out of all of that was that he became a self-taught microbiologist. And his oldest brother, Jacob, had a pharmacy. Again, this was a very democratic kind of thing. Anybody could own a drugstore in those days. Anyone could make medicine.
Coca-Cola actually came out as a medicine produced by a guy down in Atlanta, Georgia, that included cocaine in it.
Yeah, surprisingly how many things came out of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the, even hard liquor that we know of today came out of that.
Well, that's right. A lot of liqueurs with herbs, flavorings, and stuff were actually early medicines or considered medical things.
That's
yeah.
Right. So this is the milieu for his development. And it was really about making the right friends, and that's what got him to where it got him.
Well, now, his older brother, not Abraham, not Simon, the other brother, what's his name?
There's another brother, Bernard.
Now, Bernard is the one that was very well placed with people such as Morgenthau and Brandeis and Baruch.
Right.
And the Zionist movement, which probably married some of their younger brothers to some of these other plannings, it seems, because they became very important players in a larger idea. And that idea was born, when was this idea for them to start moving into the use of this knowledge in inoculation and all the rest? What time frame are we talking now? 19 what or?
Well, the real pivotal point comes when the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research is established, and that happens in 1901. And Simon Flexner became its director, who would be able to direct all the research. Private institution, of course, he had no one to answer to except the funders of his enterprise. So he handpicked his staff, and they began experimentation. That was what they were interested in.
Now, what we find here is that a couple of disease conditions that existed in the world, or at least they were aware of, such as the one that you've done most research on, was polio. When was polio brought into their purview as far as a disease condition that they could manipulate?
Well, polio really hadn't been coined as a name prior to that. The polio had been in existence as a disease condition, and it had been defined as a disease condition probably somewhere around. Well, let me go back.
Hold on. And, ladies and gentlemen, we're back from a short, unplanned break, but we're going to get right back into this discussion with Jennifer. We were talking about the relationship between the Flexner brother, Simon, and his research at the Rockefeller Institute that led him to... certain policy shifts and changes that happened as a result of this man's work at the Rockefeller Institute. Did you look into, Jennifer, did you look into his relationship to politicians in parallel to this, or was he strictly working, as far as you could see, with the Rockefeller Institute?
Well, he was pretty much, as far as I can tell, just working at his institute. But both his brothers, Bernard and Abraham, had many contacts with politicians. In fact, looking back through records of things, trying to track Abraham, I came up on pictures of them, like presidents and secretaries of this and that, and they were very, very there. They were present in politics in a big way.
Well, these movers and shakers. Now, Simon's work into the medical field began to show a sinister edge to it not long after he got underway here. I mean, there it started by his eighth or ninth year within this organization. Certain things began to emerge that should have had everybody getting nervous. Now, could you tell us what some of the things that they started doing early on?
Well, you know, the thing when you're researching and you're looking for evidence,
yep,
is facts and things that will connect one thing to another. And the only facts, really, are changes in certain kinds of large-scale activities. So I can't directly tie them to individuals. But I could see that as a nation, things were beginning to happen after the establishment of this institution, the ROC, as called.
Yep.
And one of those things was having medicants added to public water supplies.
And what were some of the things that they were adding?
Well, in 1903, they added radon. And I'm still chasing that one down.
What was the rationale that you could find, any?
I couldn't find a rationale.
could there possibly be one, you know?
Well, here, you know, based on what had come before, looking at this little period of time, from 1895 to, say, 1905, just in those 10 years, a lot of things happened. In 1895, the first x-ray was taken, the first medical x-ray,
yep,
and was recognized for its value. In 1898, Madame Curie discovered radium. Actually, as far as anyone experimenting with it, it looks like it would take another year for that to start happening. But given the free nature of medical, what would you call it, you know, this dissemination of potions, notions, nostrums, which was popular before then, you know, this sort of freewheeling medical activity, you know, couldn't wait to just absorb this and put it into use. We have a very parallel history going with chemicals and development of chemicals.
Now, the sinister nature of radiation itself, was it known? I mean, Madame Curie and her husband both died of radiation poisoning not long after their research. Their research lasted about 10 or 15 years, and they croaked from it.
Yeah. In 1907, I think her husband died. He was very ill at the time of his death.
Yep.
He was accidentally killed, but you know, it may have been because he couldn't get out of the way of a horse and buggy that ran him down. So, yes, and then Madame Curie herself, she died of leukemia, and so did her daughter and her daughter's husband, who were also Nobel-winning scientist.
So there were already indications that this new nostrum, as you've tagged it, had a dangerous side to it, and that possibly moving back into our idea of eugenics here might be able to be used as a I don't know. I know we're using stuff to thin out our herds now. We're going to get into that maybe in a little while or in another show. But, of course, radiation being a dangerous substance, and it was beginning to get known that it was, they didn't use radon everywhere, did they? They just...
Well, no. What actually was happening was that X-rays were probably the most useful thing of all.
Yeah.
And... So a lot of X-ray machines were being built and being experimented with. Thomas Edison had one of his tests in 1896, the year after X-rays are discovered. He got a lethal dose of X-ray, and it took 2 years to kill him. But in 1898, he died. And according to the books here, Edison stopped playing with radiation at that point. So how damaging and dangerous. How awful of a way it is.